Welcome to The Checkup, brought to you by Barry Nilsson's Health Law Team. The Checkup is a series of interviews, case studies and stories with some truly interesting and innovative people from all kinds of backgrounds. Lawyers, doctors, authors, cyber experts and more. Together we provide a regular dose of all the latest happenings in healthcare and tackle some of the big issues within the industry. If you'd like to hear more, make sure you subscribe on Podbean or Apple Podcasts. And if you'd like to get in touch with our team, head to bnlaw.com.au.
Welcome back to The Checkup. I'm Ashley Sherman.
And I'm Natalie Laidlaw.
And we're both lawyers in Barry Nilsson's National Insurance and Health Team. Today we're joined by psychologists and directors of Human Ethos, Sally Ryan and Carly Shriver. Welcome to The Checkup.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks so much. We were first introduced to you and your work when you presented at Barry Nilsson on the topic of empathy-based stress, specifically in relation to the work we do as lawyers. We found it a really interesting presentation and a topic we're keen to explore further. So thank you very much for joining us today to talk further about it. Before we jump into the episode, perhaps you could tell us a bit more about your professional backgrounds and the work you do at Human Ethos.
Sure. So I started my professional life as a lawyer, actually, back in 2004. I'd done a science law degree. I did my articles at one of the big commercial firms and I'd lined up a Supreme Court Judge's Associateship to immediately follow, and I went and did that. At the time, my plan was to become a barrister, but it was while I was a Judge's Associate that I kind of realised that while I loved the atmosphere of the courtroom, I was so much more interested in the psychology of it and the interpersonal dynamics than I was the legal argument, and that's when I made a decision to retrain in psychology. But I stayed working in and around the courts the whole time while I was doing that postgraduate study, and kind of along the way, I ended up embarking upon a PhD on stress for judicial officers, so the stress that judges and magistrates experience in their work, which had never been researched before in Australia. And so I did a deep dive into all the research that had been done on lawyers and became very interested in the psychological impact of legal work as well.
Great. Thanks, Carly, for sharing. Sally?
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I think my learning and progression to this point has been a little different to Carly's. I am also a psychologist, but also a family therapist. So my interest is really in thinking about how people recover from trauma and really distressing events that happen in people's lives, and working with not only people who have experienced primary trauma themselves, but also professionals who are working to support them. So I have a number of friends and family members who are lawyers, and had conversations throughout my professional life with lawyers about how they don't have the sort of support that people like psychologists have, and started to get really interested in what can maybe help lawyers as well as health professionals not only survive their work but actually really grow and enjoy their work even when it has a lot of exposure to trauma and distressing events.
Thank you. I think that's really interesting to see the different ways that you've both come into the areas that you are today and the obviously very important work that you're now doing. With all of that in mind, today we're going to be exploring empathy-based stress and more specifically, vicarious trauma and burnout. Carly and Sally have generously offered to provide their expert insight into how we can recognise the symptoms of stress, both within ourselves and in our colleagues, as well as some strategies to manage and prevent vicarious trauma and reduce its impacts on both our work performance and quality of life. So firstly, what is empathy-based stress?
So empathy-based stress is really an umbrella term to describe a range of experiences that people can have, particularly in relation to their work, when their work brings them into contact with either disturbing subject matter or people that are in distress. And what it describes is when you have features of your working environment that expose you to difficult content, people who are going through some tough times, coupled with your own stuff that you bring to it, so your own kind of level of empathic engagement and particularly the level of kind of personal identification you might have with those stories and that material. Those two come together to create, I guess, the extent of the exposure and the level of the empathic engagement. And where both the exposure and the empathic engagement are high, that can then lead to empathy-based stress in the form of compassion fatigue, vicarious trauma, secondary traumatic stress. These are terms that people have probably heard and they're all kind of defined slightly differently. But where there is insufficient, and this is, you know, a totally natural human response to this kind of work and this kind of material, but where there is insufficient time, resources, support to kind of metabolize, move through, make sense of that material and the experience, the personal experience we have in relation to it, that's when it can lead to kind of, I guess, more enduring experiences of vicarious trauma, but also burnout that can have some negative consequences for our mental health, but also our functioning at work.
And we hear a lot about burnout, particularly in the legal profession. So can you just talk us through what is burnout?
Sure. So burnout in Australia is not a diagnosable mental health disorder. It's not something within the DSM-5 that I'm sure many of your listeners would know a lot about. In Europe, interestingly, in their diagnostic manual, it is a diagnosable disorder, but it's not in Australia. But it does have a lot of resonance and currency for workers. And so it's basically an experience that's been described and defined very specifically in research literature. And it's understood to comprise three key elements. The first and really most significant is extreme emotional exhaustion. So feeling really kind of bone fatigued, the kind of fatigue that isn't alleviated with rest, a deep and enduring fatigue. The second dimension is what's called cynicism or depersonalization, where we can feel a kind of disconnection from the meaning and purpose we might derive from our work, particularly the human elements of our work. So starting to feel like clients or patients are kind of just problems to be dealt with in the course of the day, feeling like the human value of the work isn't really feeling particularly valuable to us. And then the third dimension is reduced professional efficacy. So that refers to feeling like we're unable to do our best work, that our work maybe doesn't have particular meaning or value or isn't contributing to something especially good in the world. So when those three things come together, that's where people are said to be experiencing burnout.
And what you're describing in terms of the burnout and the empathy-based stress, it seems like no profession is really untouched, because even though we're sort of talking about lawyers and health practitioners, it can quite easily extend to teachers and sort of beyond just, you know, the legal and sort of health areas. It really is far reaching in society, isn't it?
It is. And I think when anybody's work, it means that they're dealing with people in various states of well-being through various experiences in their lives, there's the potential for the exposure to burnout, to compassion fatigue, to empathy-based stress. It's really when our work requires us to engage empathically in the difficult experiences that people are having. And there are many, many occupations that have that element as part of them.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of a difficult twist that almost the most caring people and the people who are really drawn to work, you know, as you say, like teachers or health professionals or lawyers who really care about justice,
to help others.
That's right. And it's that almost that very quality of wanting to care for others and make a difference that can put us at risk of some of these things.
Makes perfect sense. The carer is the one that sort of gets it all, really,
yes,
at the end of the day.
Yeah. But it also can be the part of the person and the part of the work that becomes the most satisfying and meaningful. So it's a bit of a, you know, a tension, I think.
Now, talking about having that balance between remaining empathetic to our clients or our patients, but also having still an appropriate distance to try and prevent these situations from arising and from impacting our personal life, what are some tips that you would give to professionals such as health professionals or lawyers to enable them to strike that balance?
Yeah, look, I think there's a lot that people can do to bring that balance into their lives, and it's not any one thing, so it's good to have a combination of things. But probably the most important is to be really kind of thoughtful and clear about what your role is in your work. So it can feel, in the face of a lot of overwhelming issues and distress that people are managing, that we might want to give everything. And so being really clear about what is your job, what is your role, what skills do you need to do your job, and being quite focused and organised around the part that you play in people's lives is important. All of us can tend to go down, you know, kind of a couple of ends of a spectrum. One end where you can feel very much a tendency to be over-involved in people's lives, in clients' lives or court users' lives or patients' lives, or the other end of the spectrum, which is more distancing yourself from people's lives and people's stories. So striking a balance between being over-involved and under-involved is really important, and focusing on role can help us do that. Like, what's my part to play in this? I don't need to fix all of the picture. I just need to be good at my job and my piece in this scenario.
So understanding where you fit really in the scenario.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And I think it's important to be really conscious about that, and working in a team can be really helpful. So talking to colleagues, being clear about what your team or your organisation's role is as well, so that it becomes less about you personally contributing, but more about what's the work that you're representing. So role's probably the first one. Then I think there's so many strategies in lots of different areas of our lives that are important. So thinking about our physical selves, how we look after ourselves physically, all the dreaded ones that I don't like to think about as we approach Christmas, like right now, like exercise and diet and drug and alcohol use, keeping some perspective on those, making sure we're sleeping enough, our emotional selves, how we're kind of experiencing emotions, how we regulate those, having strategies to do that. That's where talking individually with a psychologist can be really helpful to learn personal strategies for doing that. Thinking about how you're managing your social life and talking to people, talking to colleagues, peers, having enough time by yourself as well as enough time being connected to others. Being engaged in learning, so having a lot of different ways of learning at work, but also learning new skills outside of work. And being pretty clear about why you're doing tricky work. Like, when we know why we're wanting to do hard work that sometimes exposes us to the suffering of others, having a real connection to your purpose and the meaning that you get from your work is important. So sometimes just having that in the front of our minds can be really helpful.
Makes sense. I mean, we're at work a lot in terms of, you know, the time we spend in our lives. So it makes sense to be connected to that purpose.
Yes.
And to know why you're there.
Yes.
And to come back to that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. What are some of the known risks and protective factors for vicarious trauma in organisations such as health?
So there has been quite a bit of work done on the contextual risk factors and also the personal risk factors that people can have for all forms of empathy-based stress, but particularly vicarious trauma. One of the big ones in organisations is where there's an unmanageable or kind of chronically high workload, where there's not an ebb and flow of workload pressure such that the exposure to the difficult side of the work, the difficult content, the people who might be in distress, the work may involve that. But if the workload is so high that there's not any reprieve from workload pressure such that those experiences can kind of be understood, talked about, digested, worked through, some of the practices that Sally's mentioned, that if there's no time to kind of be able to gather those together and put them into place, then that definitely increases the risk. Other things that have been identified, and this again links to what Sally mentioned about role, is where there's role ambiguity, so where people are unsure what their function is within the organisation, where that isn't made clear to them, or the structures, supports within the organisation are not clear, such that people kind of don't know how much they need to be doing, you know, how much they need to be caring, and if they're not doing it, who else is? Those kind of factors definitely increase the risk. And then long hours, again, it goes with high workload, but just not having the space to recover for pleasure, leisure, time out of work increases the risk as well.
So what are some of the signs that someone is perhaps experiencing too much stress in their work life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, look, I think we can find the signs in all kind of almost all areas of ourselves and almost all the areas that we just talked about. So we can find signs in our physical selves. So that could be problems with sleep are really common. Nightmares, if people are actually really tipping into some of the empathy-based stress. So hard time falling asleep, staying asleep, getting through the night without a nightmare, heart racing, dry mouth, feeling nauseous, hypervigilance, feeling like you're kind of on edge all the time. And it sort of makes sense that the body would feel like that because it's almost like a parallel to the experience of people who have had trauma in their lives. So when we feel a lot of empathy for them, we can almost begin to feel the same experiences in our body. So physical signs are really important to watch out for. I think there's also a cluster of signs around behaviour. So we often see people who start to withdraw from different parts of their lives or want to avoid things like social situations, avoid reading the newspaper if you're, involved in legal work around crime or health professional work where you just actually don't want to read more in the paper or hear things in the news, avoiding talking about work, avoiding, could be the opposite, avoiding going home, avoiding social situations where the work is not the focus of your life. Then there's probably a cluster of things around what we call psychological symptoms, which can be things like having intrusive thoughts, where images or sounds can come into people's minds that might be from another time and place and might even be things that they're imagining have happened to other people. People can also feel really emotionally numb and cut off and almost flat in the world. So probably things that cluster around physical feelings of threat, changes in your thinking and behaving, even changes in things like beliefs about the world. Like sometimes people talk about feeling that the world just doesn't feel like a safe place in the way that it used to before they started doing work where they were exposed to a lot of trauma.
I realise I didn't actually define earlier vicarious trauma because it's quite different from burnout. Mm. They're all kind of related experiences and they all come under this umbrella term of empathy-based stress, but vicarious trauma is really defined as a disruption to our core beliefs about ourselves, others and the world that enables the world to feel safe, predictable, that we can kind of trust that we can go about our lives and not encounter harm at every corner. When vicarious trauma starts to take hold, that's when we can just feel unsafe going about our daily lives, you know, perceiving that the risk or the risk of harm or the threat is much higher than it in fact is.
And what are some of the approaches to dealing with those symptoms of burnout that you've mentioned?
I think we can all sort of recognise some of the symptoms mm-hmm. that you have described mm-hmm. and we all sort of think, tick to that, tick to that. No, yes. I haven't had that, but I know someone with that. So what can we do to address them?
Look, it's important to emphasise that these experiences, to varying degrees, are really quite common, particularly in the kind of work that lawyers and health practitioners do. But it's matters of degree. So, and if we're talking about burnout for now, it's important to distinguish between being burnt out and burning out. So a lot of people, I think, have this idea that with burnout, you get sort of completely debilitated and the only way back is to kind of completely stop work and recover for 6 months. That is really if somebody has reached a chronic level of burnout without intervention, that sometimes those drastic measures have to be taken. But mostly when we're talking about burnout, we're talking about people who are kind of experiencing the early symptoms of it. And there are kind of three groups of strategies, things that we can do to try and manage the risk of burnout if we just know that it's a risk in our work, but also if we start to feel those early warning signs. The first is to think about, can we in any way reduce the stressors that we're facing? So burnout it's not just about empathic exposure. In fact, it doesn't even necessarily have to have a lot of empathic exposure. Burnout really comes from prolonged high workloads and interpersonal demands at work. So given that that's the origins of burnout, having to work a lot and particularly work a lot in relation to others, is there any way that workload can be tweaked? Or at least if the overall workload needs to remain high, can there be some sort of modulation in intensity built in? And this is where, and Sally and I always talk about this, occupational well-being is a shared responsibility between the individual and the organisation that they work with, because an individual can't manage those kinds of factors on their own. So how can the originating stressors of the burnout be reduced? Then secondly, how can we just de-stress generally through general well-being practices, the kinds of things that Sally was talking about in those domains of physical, social, emotional cognitive, intellectual. What have I missed?
The spiritual, the meaning and purpose.
So these are the sort of the domains of our well-being, the domains of ourselves. And it's not to say that we, you know, need to be building, you know, suddenly creating six extra hours in our week to be doing a whole lot more, you know, practices, because that's not realistic for people that are already working hard. But just remembering that there might be small things we can do that kind of keep us well in these different sides of ourselves and keep us balanced. And then finally, another identified risk factor for burnout specifically is perfectionism. So it's well known that perfectionists are much more likely to get burned out in work than non-perfectionists. And I think it kind of stands to reason that perfectionists will overwork and over-engineer and worry and
become really perfect at burnout.
Yeah, do burnout perfectly.
Do it really well.
And that's work that people can do with a psychologist to kind of identify how their perfectionism operates. What's the self-talk that perfectionism is giving rise to, and how can we start to challenge some of those kind of schemas, those belief systems that keep that in place?
Okay. So listening to it, the first point was to address the cause. So to address the cause, I guess, of the workplace stress and to manage that, and then to manage yourself and to keep yourself well. Mm. And then finally on that perfectionism front to seek assistance.
Yeah, exactly.
So perfectionism is obviously one of the risk factors that makes people more likely than others to experience vicarious trauma. Are there any other risk factors that people should know of or to look out for?
Yeah, look, I reckon perfectionism's sort of like a risk factor for all stress. It doesn't necessarily have to, you know, doesn't necessarily link to vicarious trauma, but I think there are probably some for empathy-based stress and vicarious trauma that are worth mentioning. And all of these could be protective factors as well. So it's kind of like a lot of it is it depends. So for some of us, you know, we could have had experiences in our growing up time, our families of origin, life experiences that have brought us into contact with trauma through crime or our own health issues in our family, that can help us to build resilience and build ways of coping, and we can, you know, develop a whole lot of strategies through that. But it can also give us a kind of risk and a vulnerability in those areas. So it really depends. And The other big context piece for people is what's going on in your life outside of work at the moment, which could be about life stage, life transitions, other significant events that are happening in our lives. And again, these can all be risk and protective factors depending on the nature of them. So,
and I guess it depends at what stage you are as well in terms of your professional life and what you're seeing come through the door, and also your personal life as well, and what happens, you know, and where the two sort of collide.
We often hear people talk about cases that have just out of the blue got them really unstuck, and it's often cases that involve children, because people either have kids the same age or have had things happen in their own lives at the same time, or we've all been children. We all have a sort of connection to kids. So often I reckon anything around children is one to watch out for.
And just on that, I mean, I guess taking it beyond cases involving children, cases where there's some element of kind of personal significance or personal relevance, because empathic engagement is really ramped up where there's a strong degree of personal identification with the story of suffering that we're exposed to in our work. Mm. And so if there's some aspect of a case or an individual that feels like we get it, like it feels like it could have been us, it feels really personally relevant, that's another thing that can just mean that particular case is the one that really gets to us.
And I like that you mentioned the self-talk before, Carly, because I think that's a good one to watch out for when we might be saying things to ourselves like, oh my God, this could be me, this could be my son.
That's a sign.
That's a real sign.
Yeah.
If we're really putting ourselves in the other person's shoes to that degree, that the voice in our head saying that, that's a flag to maybe talk to someone.
And how can we recognise flags in our colleagues? So, for example, Ashley and I work closely together, as we do with our team generally. And also, you know, no doubt out there in the health field, you know, colleagues would see, you know, other colleagues, you know, having tough times all the time. Yeah. But what sort of signs or what do we look out for to help out our colleagues?
Well, there's a bunch of things to look out for, and it will vary a lot from person to person because the way that these kind of experiences will be expressed outwardly are pretty personal and pretty sort of individual. I guess the overarching thing is if there's a noticeable change in behaviour or kind of emotional expression from the way a person kind of normally is in the world, that's usually something to really take an interest in looking out for a colleague. So, the extrovert who suddenly becomes quiet, or the normally really well-kempt person who is now presenting a bit more dishevelled. So there's noticeable changes are really the things we want to watch out for. Then in terms of kind of specifics, I mean, Sally's mentioned that a symptom of some of these experiences is emotional numbness, so seeing that somebody is presenting kind of emotionally flat, but also the opposite can also be true. So real emotional extremes, emotionally reactive, seeming a bit more upset or a lot more upset than they normally would be over seemingly kind of small things, not being able to let things go. What else am I missing here, Sally?
Oh, I was just thinking about the avoidance idea again. So when someone, you know, maybe stops responding to emails, is hard to get onto, doesn't return your calls, seems to have the office door closed when normally they're out and about, stop coming to lunch, you know, they're maybe telling you to back off, but it might actually be a good time to step towards someone.
And I guess professionally as well, you know, if somebody's normally really good at meeting their deadlines and now they're finding it difficult, or if their work is normally at a certain standard and then kind of suddenly it's and they're not quite producing work at their normal standard, that can be another indication.
I think it's just a lot of, you know, being aware of what your colleagues are normally like, how they normally present, and just being attuned to those subtle changes. They might be subtle or they might be more obvious, but just remaining conscious of that. How can we assist our colleagues who might be struggling in those ways?
Well, you've sort of, in some ways, you've already started to answer that question, because some of it is about just knowing your team, knowing your colleagues well, and kind of ongoingly talking to each other about how you're going at work.
Yeah.
And having, you know, having a culture in teams where it's totally on the table to expect that people are going to have rough days, and have people who, managers and leaders who are really comfortable to have conversations with their teams about what that's like without people feeling as though that's kind of an embarrassing or shaming or sort of negative experience. Just actually we're all, when we're doing work that's this challenging, that involves trauma, we're all going to have a tough time from time to time. So there's a lot of kind of prevention stuff, I think. I think being prepared to just actually openly let people know that you've noticed that something's different, and being prepared to listen, ask open-ended questions, not jump in too quickly to problem solve, even though it can be really tempting to do that. Asking people what they kind of need from us as colleagues. It might be that someone just wants to regularly have a coffee and till they get through a tricky time. Might be that people need work to actually change a little bit. Yeah, so I think if you're talking to colleagues, even colleagues who you're concerned about or who you think might be struggling, you can use warmth and humour, but if that's the only way that you're talking to each other, or you notice that the way that you're speaking has been offensive to someone, that's a red flag. You usually joke around with your colleagues. If you notice that they don't like it, that might mean that something's up with them, or it might mean you've got a bad sense of humour.
So it's being not only aware of your colleagues but also yourself as well.
Yeah, yeah. It all starts with self-awareness.
Yeah, the double whammy.
That's true.
Yeah. We've talked a lot about empathy-based stress and empathy being, you know, empathic engagement being a risk factor for these kinds of experiences. We would not want to be misunderstood to be saying that empathy is somehow a problem. Empathy is such a key human quality that makes us good at our work, enables us to derive meaning from our work. In fact, Burnout, you might remember when I was describing burnout, I talked about an element of burnout being cynicism, which is basically when we kind of lose any capacity to kind of empathise with the people in our work as kind of human beings. So when we remove that, we remove our capacity to derive meaning from our work and satisfaction, which is one of the sustaining forces in this work that we do. So it's not about finding a way to cut off empathy, no way. That's a real kind of, that leads to problems as well. It's about finding a way to manage our empathy so that we're staying in role, we're empathising with the people that we're working with in the service of what's helpful for them in a compassionate way. So we can feel into their experience, but we are mostly holding how can we be helpful and where can we go from here, so that there's still a kind of heart connection, but it's sustainable.
I think there are some times when you are a professional in the health field or otherwise, you know, lawyers, that sort of thing, there's only so much you can learn through studying in your degree. And, you know, what makes a good health practitioner or makes a good lawyer sometimes isn't the marks at the end of the day. Mm. It's the empathy that they have and the feeling and their personality that all sort of goes into making them the best doctor or the best occupational therapist or the best physio or the best psychologist or the best lawyer. There's a lot more that goes into it than just the marks.
Yeah.
And I think people do sometimes forget that empathy actually does go a long, long way in interpersonal skills and how you interact with everyone.
Mm. And how people experience the justice system.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an incredibly interesting and insightful conversation, one I think that not only health professionals would benefit from, but also many professionals generally.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having us.
If you'd like to know more about Sally and Carly's work at Human Ethos, we'll include some of the links in the show notes to their website. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Checkup. To get in touch with our national health law team or subscribe to our health law insights, head to www.bnlaw.com.au. Thanks very much.